Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every day talking about HR with the people who care about it and actually do know something about it. So we need to get to our guest as quickly as possible because she knows a lot about it. Karen, welcome to Drive Through HR.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, if you would, introduce yourself to our lovely family of listeners.
Okay, well, my name is Karen Beeman, and I am the CEO and founder of Jaytaza Group International. We're a global HR consultancy focusing on business strategy, research, and the work around what are some of the leading practices in HR. We have done many systems deployments from the early days of the mainframe era through the mini computer and client server, and now into the world of cloud computing. So I've been
Karen,
doing this for about 35 years now, I guess. So I have also the world of HR is kind of my only world.
And you've obviously seen a lot of things through the years. Let's ask the traditional question we ask is, what's keeping you up at night? So what's top of mind for you these days?
Yeah, well, top of mind for me and what a lot of, us in Jaytaza are concerned a lot with is how to really make technology an enabling platform for the modern human resource professional. You know, it's having seen the technology evolve over the years, we've certainly made enormous strides from the days when we were, in key punched cards and the being in the back office. But there's still so much more still to do. You know, I think that we always talk about how computers are taking on some, artificial intelligence types of processes. And how do they really help people be more effective? Because sometimes we have the feeling that computers almost hold us back more than help us, right? And so the thing that really that I struggle with is how to help vendors really make their software and their technology more intuitive, more usable, and how do we achieve greater adoption with technology so it's really an enabler and not an inhibitor. That's the main thing that I struggle with.
Well, it's
not an easy problem, right?
No, it's not. And vendors used to have the relationship with practitioners that basically said, okay, go figure it all out, And now
right, or it's our software, take it or leave it, right?
Well, yeah, who owns, at the end of the day, who owns change management? Does the practitioner group own change management, or does the vendor own change management?
Yeah, I think, well, certainly the practitioner, the client company owns change management. But what I'm saying is sometimes the vendors just don't make it easy for the clients to take that software usable. Sometimes they don't have consistency from, some of the biggest issues when companies acquire other companies. So there's a totally different user interface when you go from learning to recruiting to comp or something like that. And I don't think that vendors really appreciate how difficult that really is for the end users and what a change management problem that creates, but just how hard it is for the users to try to use software that every screen you go to acts a little bit differently, responds differently. I think that's a lot of the challenge.
Do you see some vendors doing it better than others? I'm not explicitly asking you to name names. I'm just trying to help the audience kind of see examples of where it's working and where it's not.
Well, Well, I do think some of the newer vendors, I think particularly SaaS and the whole movement toward a consumer-oriented user interface is making a lot of strides in that arena. I mean, it's certainly easier. I think what companies like Amazon and Google have done is shown that you can create a very usable user interface, very simple, that you learn how to adapt without the need for, you know, lengthy training courses and things like that. I think those vendors that are moving quickly into SaaS and embracing a consumer-oriented user interface are making greater progress, absolutely.
Because you travel so much, Karen, you've obviously seen things that happen all over the globe. What are some of the software pitfalls that you see in terms of kind of global expansion? I mean, we obviously see all the things that happen here in the United States or a lot of the things that happen here in the U.S., but what, in your travels, where do you see some of the pitfalls in kind of global expansion of software?
Yeah, I think when I for expansion, I think of four different levels, actually. I think at the first and the most basic level is just, you know, do you have the data fields to collect the information that you need? Can you enter in the very lengthy last names that you need to in Spain, for example? Can you enter in different address types? So this gets, when you think about it, fairly basic, but fairly complex because there's a lot of different formats for every country. And so at its most basic level is, can we collect the data that's needed? And it goes beyond things like names and addresses to capturing things like religion in Germany, because you need to pay your church dues or a direct payroll deduction, or capturing your father's birthplace in China, the Hukou, all of those types of laws and regulations. So it's just capturing the, you know, for every country. The second level then gets into, language translations. If all of your system is in English or in one language, how accessible is that to people who really don't speak English that well as a second language? And so if you've got your system, you know, not the end user screens not translated to the native language, you're going to obviously run into greater problems with adoption. And then the third level has more to do with business processes. Can you change your business processes for each country? Like in Germany, you need to get Works Council's approval for a salary increase. So can you make your business process different in Germany than it is in the U.S. or Canada? And then at the most complex level, getting into local compliance requirements. Can you submit, you know, the training requirements reports that you have to do in France or the disability reporting in Germany? And so when you think about going global with software, you really have to know what level are you looking at. If you're looking at just basic data collection, then there's a set of software products out there that can meet that requirement very well. If you're looking for specific language translations, you've got to look at maybe more advanced and other types of software. And finally, if you really are looking for, you know, local compliance requirements in, you know, the countries that you're in, that requires an even more sophisticated product that you have to be evaluating. Number of different things. Not to make your question more complicated.
That was fantastic. You know, if someone's never gone global, so pick a software play, and let's say they don't have global clientele, but they aspire to have clients in Australia or the UK or pick a place. As a practitioner, does that scare you if they don't have clients in your particular region, or do you go with the tried and true, someone that's, you know, got 1,000 clients or 100 clients in your particular area, or is it better to get what you think is better software, but not necessarily that's got the global clientele?
Preference is more sort of the last thing that you said. I think if you go for a vendor that's got 1,000 clients in a country or whatever, you're probably going for older software, right? Because they've been around a while and developed quite a client base. So generally, I would say that I'd be more inclined to, maybe because I have a technical background, spent all my life in this industry, analysis. Do I feel comfortable that they capture the data, have the languages, can configure the business processes, and have the compliance that they need? If I could go through that checklist, if you will, of these, you know, oh, it's 100 things, not, you know, it's not the 20-thing checklist, then I would feel comfortable. It wouldn't matter necessarily how many clients I had if I felt that the product was built on the right foundation with the right data model and with the right, you know, levels of globalization that I was looking for. So I would feel comfortable if I had done this type of analysis of their software at not just listening to what the sales folks said, sorry for that, but diving into, you know, what does the product really do, right? And can it really, you know, capture disability in Germany, for example? I want to see that data field. Show me where that is. Show me the report that reports on training hours in France. And when you see those, then I would feel confident whether they had two clients or, you know, 100 clients wouldn't matter if I saw the functionality.
All right, I got to get your take on RFPs. Are you a lover or a hater or a buyer or a seller of RFPs? What's your take?
I guess I would say I'm more of a hater of them because I just think the tendency for check every box and say, yes, we can. I know you're snickering because that's right. Of course we can do it, but with, you know, hundreds of hours of modifications or whatnot, or, you know, hundreds of hours of implementation afterwards. So the problem with an RFP is it's just too generic. It's just way too generic. And so I think that I'm a fan of the scripted demo. You know, show me, these are the 500 things I want to see, and I'm going to check them off one by one. It might be excruciating, but it is the only way you can make sure that of the 500 things you want, they have 85% of them. All of your requirements, of course. But if you at least have a list of the 500 things you know you need, you can go through and check them off with two or three vendors, show me this, show me that, and not take it from an RFP checkbox or take it from, you know, a salesperson's mouth. You want to see it in a scripted demo. That's data in my mind.
I love that. Because you've seen a lot of software, you've obviously seen a lot of software here, and you've seen a lot of software abroad, et cetera. What do we get right in the HR and recruiting software market here in the United States, and where do other places kind of get it right that you wish that could be, you could import it to the United States, et cetera?
Well, you know, I think the U.S. does a very good job on understanding you know, data models. I believe we have, you know, some of the vendors out there have some just really great data models and really understand HR in the full palette of HR, from core to recruiting to comp, you know, talent learning, all of the functionalities. I think that's one thing that in the U.S. you do pretty well is understanding this concept of an integrated or unified HCM. I think in the other countries, you know, what do they do well? Honestly, there's a bigger focus on compliance, and I think they have a broader understanding of what you need for compliance and regulatory requirements. Many of the countries have many more regulatory requirements than we do in the U.S. It's countries like Brazil, you know, they're highly regulated, so they understand more how important that is and why that should be tied in with your systems much more than we in the U.S. In the U.S., we tend to say, oh, the vendor doesn't need to worry as much about it. That's the client's problem. They push it onto the client. And that's fine, except for that it's a big job, and every client is out there building the same compliance report over and over again, where I think many times in some of the other countries they understand how critical it is to have compliance an inherent part of the product.
All right. So if you had a blank screen,
in fact,
A woman just on the show 2 weeks ago was hired at a company in New York, and there was nothing. Literally, the company had nothing, and CFO gave her the budget to just do whatever she wanted. So if that were a case, where would you start? Would you start with core HR and then build outward and put talent management around core HR, or would you start with talent management, build that, and then go and bolt core HR onto talent management? What's your preference, I guess?
Well, Well, you know, I guess I'm a traditionalist, and so I always figure you want to build the foundation first. So you want to start with but I would also say a lot of it depends on whether there's a burning platform in a particular case. If there's a seriously burning platform around recruiting, then, you know, I might start there. You know, if they're not able to hire and they're up track and they're not able to meet their grounds, then, you know, maybe it makes sense to go for, you know, a recruiting application. So I would still say that any type of burning platform would trump the need to go with a traditional approach of let's do the core first, followed by talent.
All right. So now I got to ask you the age-old question of process versus products. So this is the chicken and egg, cleverly disguised chicken and egg discussion of process versus products. What comes first in your mind, and what's more important?
Oh, well, at the end of the day, you know, process is more important, but I would say that if a product makes it such that your process is so convoluted that it makes it difficult to build a streamlined process, then you have to, I guess I always think about both. I think of the product as an enabler of the process. And so I don't really think you can do one without the other. So if you are, say you're an SAP shop because that's what your whole company has, right? And so you are, you know, that's the product that you have to work with. Well, you can make processes work within that environment that work well with that product. Likewise, if you're a PeopleSoft, Oracle, or Workday shop, whatever, I think you work with the product that you have to build the most effective processes. Now, if you have a blank slate and you have unlimited funds and you can go, you know, map out your perfect processes and then go buy a product that might comes closest to meeting those perfect processes, great, but I don't know too many companies that have that type of blank slate to do that. Many are saddled with legacy software. They're saddled with the situation, so you have to work within your existing environment with the idea that you know where you're going to. So I think you have to take both into consideration. Where you are today, where do you want to go, how do you use the technology that you have at your disposal today, and then how do you either augment or replace it in cases where it's weak and not meeting the needs. So you have to develop a step-by-step approach to it, and you have to look at both together, in my mind.
So Workday once billed itself as highly configurable, highly customizable SaaS, and there's a lot of folks that kind of bill themselves in a very similar way. Is there a downsize? And in your mind, is there a downside to highly configurable or highly customizable?
Well, so configurable and customizable, right? We like to distinguish between the two in the purest sense, because customizable, in a purest, in at least the way I define it, means you're changing code. And so anytime there's a new release of the product out there, you have to reapply any code change. Boxes and building rules, and so any new release is, you don't have to change that. All of that is automatically upgraded with the new release. So first off, I think there's a big difference between customizable and configurable. I think the other issue is that, yes, there's upsides and downsides to both. And so the ideal vendor or product would balance effectively providing the right amount of configurability without making it overly complex. Because you can make, I certainly know in the mainframe days, we had some incredibly, totally configurable applications, but they were so complex it took a programmer to require so many abstract rules to build. So that was highly configurable, but so much so that it took the power away from the hands of a power user, for example. So I think the ideal vendor really looks to balance the right amount of configurability to allow you to do the things you need to do to change business rules for different business units or different locations, different situations, but not making it overly complex that you now need to have a bevy of technical people to maintain it, right? So that's where configurability can, if you will, where you it requires you then to have a whole army of people.
Karen, this is Brian. How would you guide leaders of technology companies to start expressing and building and conveying what innovation really looks like to them. That seems to be a buzzword, and people get stuck. How would you approach it if you were leading a company?
William,
Brian,
until she comes back, how would you approach that if you were leading a company?
Hey, she's back on, and she is unmuted. Hey, Karen.
How are you? Sorry, I don't know what happened to that. Where did you lose me?
Internet technology, love it. I was asking, and this is Brian, I was just asking, how would you define technology? How would you define innovation?
Now that's a nice term. That's been used a lot in the industry. I define innovation as anything that really helps you do something better than the way you were doing it before. So it can be incremental. Doesn't have to be radical. I think it can be things from self-service and metrics that are talked about a lot to more elaborate things like predictive analytics and using big data. So I think innovation is, in my mind, most effective innovation is incremental, where you keep pushing the envelope and doing a little bit more, a little bit better than you did yesterday.
How would you coach or help leaders of companies out, technology companies, to convey their idea of what innovation is better?
Well, I think that, you know, for the challenge with technology companies is they have to provide all the basics, and then they have to talk about the innovation and how they're doing things differently. So I think they would do well to distinguish between the two. Okay, here's the basic, the foundation, where many products are the same, and I think when you really get down to it, there is a large percentage, 80% of the basic of what an HR product does. It's very similar from product to product. But there is a fair amount of differentiation in things like you mentioned configurable business processes, which Workday is an innovator in, to areas like predictive analytics, where a number of vendors are moving in that space. So I think that they would do well to, again, talk about the commonalities and the basic platform, and then talk about those differences, why they're different, and what the value of that innovation brings, right? So if it's predictive analytics, how does that help them be a more strategic HR organization, bring better value to the business by providing, you know, more business analytics? I think they would do better by not just showing a bunch of, you know, metrics on the screen, but showing what is the business value of the client using that in sort of real life scenarios.
Karen, what, and out of all the things that have been innovated in our lovely world, what are you shocked about that hasn't been innovated, or what still lags behind all the other things in your mind?
Yeah, I tell you, the thing that brings me the most disappointment is I would have to say it has a lot to do with date effect to, you know, regress or view a set of data as it was at any point in time in the past or as it might be in the future. And, you know, I know some products do some of this, but I mean full data, you know, relativity and full ability to go back. And I want to see what did my organization look like 2 years ago, and now I want to look at it last year and this year, and I want to do some comparative analysis so that I can look at trends. I think that, you know, we do a great job of that in Excel, looking at things like turnover trends and stuff like that. But it's all in Excel. We don't have the tools to do that in our HR systems today, and I think that's a big disappointment because that's where we start bringing that strategic value, right, to the boardroom. Because now you're able to show, hey, we had these recruiters doing this work, you know, 2 years ago, and these are the sources where our best sources of hire, and these are the people retained, and here's their productivity over the years. And this recruiter has a higher, you know, rate of retention than another recruiter or this source. And all of that we have to take out of our HR system and do it in Excel. And I think that our HR system should have that ability to do that. But in order to do that, you have to have full date sensitivity and be able to regress the database at any point in time so that you can look at it quarter over quarter, month over month, year over year. And, you know, data storage now is so cheap. I understand why we didn't do this, you know, 20, 30 years ago, but it's very cheap right now. And so there's no reason why we can't capture the amount of data that we need to do that. It's the tools and the software that's holding us back. And it's our, I guess it's the technicians' lack of understanding how important that concept is in being able to deliver that is really a business-driven system that really brings you business value.
Is what you just described kind of the future of business intelligence, or is that just a business intelligence? Is that just a word that has gone away?
Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe the big word is big data now. I mean, I do think it's an opportunity for big data, but I assume is what is big data? You know, the way I'm hearing it, and, you know, correct me if you're hearing differently, but I'm hearing it's a grand data warehouse, right? We're going to take all the data out of all of our different systems and bring it together, and that's great. But is it going to be date sensitive in a way that you can regress the data and look at anything point of time? I mean, it's fine with me if it's in a separate repository, if it's not directly in the HR system, because then you do have the advantages of bringing your financial data and your marketing data and all of that together in one repository. But I don't hear so much, I mean, I hear talk about it, but I don't necessarily see it happening yet where we are really looking at a fully date-sensitive type of repository with the tools that are going to allow us to say, I want to look at turnover years for this recruiter who hired from this particular source. That's where I think we're going, and I know there's some pretty innovative, great tools out there like Visier and Authority for reporting, but I still think we're not there yet because of the lack of of not having the data available and the lack of understanding about date sensitivity. I think it all boils down to we just have to do a better job of keeping every single data element in a date-sensitive way in a data repository. Otherwise, we won't be able to do this type of trend analysis that I think is so critical.
Well, Karen, we've got time for one more question. And on what you were just referencing, do you feel it's the investment's not been made to have the right person, people, team actually that have the capability to do that analysis and marry together the, you know, big data with the business practices to really use that information in a, you know, statistically?
Well, I guess I think there's two problems. I do think that's part of the problem. I do think there are people who know this and can do this. But I think the other thing that we haven't really said here is that if I go back and look at the current state of where we are in the industry, I mean, it's a little bit sad because we do this Going Global survey every year, right, for the past 6 years. And it hasn't really changed much in that this one particular statistic that causes me the most distress is that only about half of the companies surveyed, and it's about 100 people we survey, different people every year, only about half of them have 100% of their data, HR data, in one single database. Most of them, the other half, shall we say, don't. They have it in two or three different systems, or they just don't have one single data repository for their entire workforce. And that is, I think, what's holding us back more than anything, is the state of, we don't have the foundational data yet. If you figure that half of the companies out there still don't have a single database of record, how could they begin to think about analytics and, you know, regression and looking at big data and those types of reporting needs? They don't even have the basics taken care of yet. So I think that's the sad situation that we're in, and I think it boils down to when you look at investments in technology, and we all know this, HR is almost at the end of the road in marketing technology as well, and frankly, they're a little bit further behind. So between HR and marketing, those two functions in our organization seem to get the least attention when it comes to technology, right? The IT systems, certainly the financial systems, they get the lion's share of the business. That's where a lion's share of the budget. I think that's where we need to make a better case for why, you know, companies need to invest in HR technology, but they need to see the upside. They need to see the value, and I think we haven't done as good a job as presenting that as we should, and that's why we're often in the situation of not getting the funding that we need. So it's kind of a catch-22, right, at the end of the day.
Sure. Well, Karen, thank you so much for coming on and spending lunch with us. Great conversation. That's you got a lot of experience.
Good questions.
Great lens on that. So it was a good way to start a Monday. Need to do this every Monday or figure something out close to that anyway. So, but again, thanks for coming on. Really, really enjoyed it. Everybody, download the show. Show some love. And last question real quick, where can people connect with you if they just want to say congratulations or ask you more questions?
Sorry?
Where can folks connect with you if they want to ask you more questions or just say great show?
Oh, okay, certainly. You can contact me at contact@jeitosa.com, jeitosa.com, or karen.beeman at jeitosa.com. I look forward to hearing what you have or any questions that you have. Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Well, perfect. Folks, we're out of here. Have a good rest of the day. Thank you for listening.
It might seem crazy.